Okay. So, I thought I was immunized from being a session chair by virtue of never having written a paper on gamma ray bursts. Yes, on the contrary. The first speaker this morning is Bohdan Pachinski, who will talk about progenitors, what and where are they?
I think I do not need this gadget. I tend to speak too loud anyway, and when I get excited, I speak even more loudly.
Except you need it so we can record you.
Record it. Is there a way to tune it down?
Okay.
You asked for it. Okay. Sorry. But some of
the...
Yeah, whatever. It is very common for us to make fun out of those people who, I forgot their name, neoconstructionists, whatever. That Sokol made fun of.
Deconstructionists.
Okay. They accuse scientists of constructing or deconstructing the universe, I can never remember, and that has supposed, according to them, has nothing to do with reality. I think if they did what Sokol did and selected gamma ray burst theory as an example, they would score high. And I think the track record of this field is, even by high energy astrophysics standards, pretty outrageous. That makes me excited, of course. There is another philosophical remark. When Batzi results came in, there was a series of papers and comments in Nature, and one of the commentary notes had a title, Astronomy versus Astrophysics. What they had in mind was there was apparent conflict between simple, classical, textbook astronomical arguments. How do you infer distances on the basis of the observed distribution? And that was opposed by supposedly astrophysical arguments based on models. And here, of course, the difference is those who are not astrophysical, those who are high-energy astrophysics models, and there is a distinction. Basically, in the spirit, you have mathematics, you have physics, you have astrophysics, and then you have high-energy astrophysics. Okay, I think, sorry, I the message is clear what I think about the current situation. That is basically the problem, I think, is how can we constrain the models, or better yet, how can you gain any real understanding into what is happening? Here is a very sketchy account of diversity of gamma ray bursts as we see them. Batzi discovered gamma ray bursts from Earth, presumably from some lightnings in the stratosphere. I do remember that prominent theoreticians claimed that's impossible because there are no lightnings in the stratosphere, and lightnings at the sea level will not make gamma rays which will get out to the outer space. Well, there are apparently those lightnings, and there are bursts from the sun. We have soft gamma repeaters, we have two or three Mach 5th type events, and notice energy scale keeps going up. Then we had a very likely, though not proven, it's difficult to prove anything with a single case after the fact, we have this no high energy gamma ray burst, possibly associated with a supernova. The energy level is vastly larger than Mach the 5th, yet orders of magnitude less than the most feeble classical gamma ray burst. And then, of course, you have classical gamma ray bursts, and here are a few examples, cover quite a range in energy output. And if we define classical gamma ray bursts as gamma ray bursts which are at cosmological distances, then there is no way for me to lose a bet. And I think as you look at this table, you may notice that gradually different types of births, which are originally bunched together, started to be removed from the category of classical gamma ray bursts. So by now, even if we accept that that coincidence was real, we would not probably classify it together with what we call classical gamma ray bursts. One thing which I noticed just before breakfast today, so this may be totally irrelevant because units actually don't agree, when you look at the range of observed energetics as observed for classical gamma ray bursts, it seems to be broader than the observed flux function. Just let me show you what I have in mind. Here are standard BATSI results. Notice at the rather modest dynamical range from the strongest to the weakest. This is barely more than two orders of magnitude. With a very small sample of classical gamma ray bursts for which redshifts were measured, we seem to have three orders of magnitude, perhaps more.
Of course, because the measured GRBs are in one order of magnitude of flux.
So, here we go. Yet, notice that flattening of the counts here clearly indicates we are running out of gamma ray bursts. So it is not what is a typical problem when you have events which are barely above the detection limit, like in, say, extragalactic radio sources, where at the time, where you have a very strong correlation between the apparent, all of them have essentially the same apparent flux. So those which are distant are very luminous. And the range of luminosity is just an artifact of the range in distance scale. This is not, I think, the case with gamma ray bursts, where this flattening of the count clearly indicates you are sampling pretty much the whole population of classical gamma ray bursts. Again, from now on, with a possible exception for a short comment on the supernova 1998 BW, I'll refer to gamma ray bursts having in mind just those classical gamma ray bursts. I think, contrary to what was said here over the last few days, those classical gamma ray bursts must be the majority of what BATSI sees, because if you divide them into those three groups, classical, no high energy photons, and short gamma ray bursts, only those classical show evidence for truncation. Yet when you put them all together, obviously they dominate. Because, mm-hmm. Yes?
I'm also sure that what you said is correct in the sense of that we are obviously not in a situation where all the sources that you've seen are just above the detection limit. Because if you fall in all the criteria that are required to get a good location and determine the redshift, it may indeed be that most of the sources, if you restrict yourself to the sample for which the redshift is known, that with the present state of technology, you can't actually do it for beta.
I disagree, but thank you for reminding me. I went to ask you, interrupt me as often as you can. I don't have any really 40 minutes to talk about. So any discussion will be most welcome. The reason I disagree, Ralph, is because I saw your diagram which you showed me, and that was the burst intrinsic luminosity versus measured redshift. And it was, if anything, it was inverse of what you would expect if what you say is a typical case. The bursts which are most closest to us seem to be brighter. So intrinsic luminosity, it seems to be a slowly decreasing function of the measured redshift. Isn't that is, you have opposite correlation than you would expect. So there's something funny in it. Of course, we are talking about a very small number of statistics. Still, I think, please note that this truncation clearly seen by BATSI is a consequence only of what classical gamma ray bursters do. No high energy bursts and short bursts follow the Euclidean slope. So they cannot possibly produce this bend. Yes?
When you were saying we're running out of bursts there, it's essentially if we take the sort of things that Tavani and others were serious, mm-hmm. we're running out of the 30%
This is what I'm trying to bring across. It cannot be 30% because that deficiency here is factor of 10. 30% cannot make factor of 10 deficiency. Still, most bursts are at the faint end, not at the bright end. So the fact that there is such a deficiency, in my judgment, is impossible to reconcile with the frequent claim of 30%. This must be a majority. Otherwise, you would not see a factor of 10 departure from the Euclidean slope. Well, in any case, there is obviously some issue which is not easily resolvable. That's good. We have something to argue about. Let me try to go beyond what we have and try to have a very subjective presentation of what I think we know and what we do not know. And again, I have only long, hard gamma ray bursts, the classical gamma ray bursts in mind, because these are the only type for which we have any statistics at all. We have six redshifts for them. So six is better than one or zero. I think there is no doubt whatsoever that they are highly relativistic explosions. I mean, there are several lines of argument which are as robust as they come. So I consider this to be virtually proof. Yes, classical hard long gamma ray bursts are ultra-relativistic explosions with the humongous Lorentz factors, well over 100. How this happens is not clear, but this is clearly an observable. I think it is equally clear, at least in my judgment, that afterglows are the results of interaction between the, whatever ejecta are and the interstellar medium, circumstellar medium, intergalactic medium, some medium which is around the exploding object. I think this is beyond any reasonable doubt. Emission is clearly non-thermal, both for gamma ray bursts and for the afterglows. Very broad power law spectra clearly indicate that this is a non-thermal emission. Is it synchrotron? That's the most popular, but we heard about inverse Compton. Then, I don't know how I omitted that, gamma ray bursts, classical gamma ray bursts, are obviously in galaxies. That was not obvious a priori that they are in galaxies. Not only they are in galaxies, there is no evidence they are preferentially at galactic nuclei. So I think this is a very strong piece of evidence for something, and what that something is up to us to figure out. Then we have weaker things, like they are almost certainly deep. We had very nice presentation yesterday, especially by Eli Waxman, quite convincing. Still, that analysis was done so far so thoroughly for one object only. The reason why I have prejudice towards beaming is not energy. The prejudice is because the most similar objects which I can think of are blazars. They are very relativistic jets, Lorentz factors 10 or 20. They have spectra remarkably similar to gamma ray burst spectra. They vary. There's just a difference in time scale and intensity scale. It's very tempting to do what Martin Rees already suggested, that this is just basically a difference in the mass scale of the central engine. Energy is much more concentrated amount, around a more compact, lower mass black hole. Still, I wish we had better empirical evidence for beaming. Jonathan Aarons pointed out to me that the most ultra-relativistic outflows we know have Lorentz factors of a million, and these are radio pulsars. And they are basically quasi-spherical, not beamed at all. I mean, beaming is trivial over there compared to, say, blazars. So this beaming, I would say, is a place where I start to wonder how confident are we that they are beamed. Then the central engine, this is a very critical point, and I don't think there is any real consensus. Right now, I think the majority vote would be that the central engine lives long. Yes? Shri?
We have not discussed this so far in the conference, but the extent, the statistics are not so secure, but Brindley has a paper analyzing
this can be no more or no less. Beaming is at least 0.1 or no more than 0.1?
No less, sorry, no more than 0.1.
So it is more beam. That is, sorry? It's more open.
I think it only applies to saying that the X-rays are no more beam than the gamma rays by that amount.
Sure. Okay, that's what I said. This is basically the
afterglow. Yes. I'll come to that point in a minute. I think it's more confusing than usually appreciated. But thank you for bringing it up. I think I've forgotten about it. Actually, I did forget. So the issue, how long does the central engine live, is, I think, not resolved. My preference, and I think the preference of most those who spoke already, is towards the statement that the central engine lives for a long time, that is the duration of the burst, but I don't think we have a proof of that, and there are some uncomfortable correlations or lack of correlations which I think make it a bit shaky. Then the origin, again, my prejudice is to associate the origin with the death of a massive star. I think we have marginal evidence in favor of that, but far, far from any proof. I think for historical reasons, merging neutron stars hypothesis is still very popular, perhaps even more popular than the death of a massive star. Then we have really a domain where, as far as I can see, we have just speculation this time because quantitative models are so difficult. Two major popular mechanisms which were suggested are how do you transfer energy from whatever central engine is out and into the explosion. This is a problem which has not been really well solved for type 2 supernovae. So note that for type 2 supernovae we had a lot of people working for many decades having fantastic amounts of empirical evidence, and it is my understanding, Stan, perhaps you can correct me, that on purely theoretical grounds we could not prove that type 2 supernovae must explode. We are getting there, but at any time over the last 2 decades, since I started to read papers on the subject, there was always a prevailing view, yes, we are almost there, except every few years the specific reasons why people thought we are almost there was drifting, changing. So I don't think the issue has stabilized. Just, I think, I'd like to put it for reference. With the gamma ray bursts, we had vastly less direct observational evidence for what's going on, and much less man years invested in trying to understand what is happening. And for me, the situation of theory of type 2 supernovae is sort of a benchmark against which it is useful to calibrate what we do for the gamma ray bursts. Now, neutrino annihilation is a very popular mechanism, and I believe Stan will talk about it in half an hour. My main problem with that is the argument presented by Stan himself several years ago. That was in a context of spherical case, which is easy to understand, very easy to model. You can put as many shells as you wish. And basically the problem, the way I understand it, for the spherical case was the following. You have somewhere surface of an object where beyond that surface there's almost vacuum, and well below that surface you have neutrino sphere. And neutrino annihilations happen not only in the vacuum, but in fact preferentially in the high density medium, because angles of incidence are more preferable for annihilation. And they deposit highly super Eddington luminosity in that high density medium, lifting those up and generating sub-relativistic, almost quasi-static wind. That is my simple-minded understanding of what Stan did several years ago, as soon as people started to speculate. Globally, if you have a rotating object, of course situation is different, but locally it's very similar. You have surface of a torus, for example, from which neutrino annihilation blow high-density, slow wind. And then we have to make an assumption, which should be as explicit as they come, that conservation of angular momentum prevents that dense wind from filling in the rotation axis, that the funnel around the rotation axis stays reasonably clean of matter, and neutron annihilations happening over there can drive ultra-relativistic wind, because energy density to mass density ratio will be suitably high over there. But we should remember that we do not assume conservation of angular momentum for the disk itself. If we assumed that, if you said that there is no angular momentum transport, then there will be no accretion, no energy release. So we have to say, in the disk, we have efficient, in fact, very efficient angular momentum transfer, but that process stops functioning once we are into the slow wind domain. This is possible. I don't know of any quantitative model. I cannot imagine how to do it in a reasonable amount of computing time. And I think there is nothing wrong with making this assumption, but it should be clearly stated as an assumption to be worked on in some quantitative detail later on. Until that is worked out, we have to realize that neutrino annihilation scenario is ad hoc. And the same, of course, goes for Blanford's Nyack or any other magnetic type model. I talked with Roger yesterday, and he told me that, he can invent very simple geometrical models where Blanford's Nyack would be very effective, but, of course, he cannot prove that nature chooses such models. I think this is another way of saying we just don't know. And people talk about not only Blanford's Nyack, also about magnetic flares, whatnot, but I have not seen a quantitative, believable model where it was demonstrated that, yes, indeed, it is possible to get very high energy density to rest mass density ratio as required by any firewall, which basically means any firewall model uses the initial conditions just as that initial ad hoc conditions. That's a bit like Big Bang prior to inflation. Not that I have high confidence in inflation, but that this inflation replaced totally ad hoc initial conditions with something which is a bit more, at least looks a bit more scientific. Now, so what makes gamma ray bursts? The most popular models currently in the literature are of two types. First, and this is perhaps still the most popular, historically the model which made it easy for some people to accept cosmological distance scale, is that we have old massive stars merging, pairs of neutron stars or a black hole with a neutron star merging into basically a black hole and a high density torus. Prediction, that is, that was before people started to tinker with the model, is that those events should be far away from star forming regions. It is trying to bring those events closer to star forming regions, at least closer to the main body of a galaxy. People tend to think now about mergers of black holes with neutron stars, because those perhaps are moving slower than pairs of neutron stars, which move fast and go far away. One of the major problems, which I don't think how to solve other than by observations, is we have not detected yet a single pair of a stellar mass black hole with a neutron star, for whatever reason. Perhaps this is just a small number of statistics. By the time we have several hundred binary neutron stars, we also shall have several pairs of black holes with neutron stars, but we don't have any. Right. Recycled, necessarily recycled, even young, not millisecond.
That's not true.
There's a paper we just put out in FJ, which disproves the idea that 2203 plus 46 was considered, which is a double neutron star system, very often has been seen, measured, and so on. We detected the white dwarf in that system. So, in fact, that right away shows that the idea these are all the statistics that people assume, the only reason we see them is because recycling is not true, because the 2203 is now a young neutron star.
Okay, one way or the other, we have some degree of controversy here. I would like to add, being an old wise man by now, a philosophical cautionary remark. If we find good reasons, good theoretical reasons, why it is impossible for us to detect black hole neutron star pairs, this is not argument in favor of their existence. Using similar argument, you could claim that ancient Egyptians had wireless telephone system because we cannot find any wires. excavations. I mean, it's a very risky thing. That is, we have to realize that while it is quite possible that those systems exist, and they may have a desirable property that they merge not far away from the places of their origin, we do not have empirical evidence in favor of that. And we went so many times badly wrong by making too long a chain of theoretical reasoning that I think, well, obviously I cannot rule it out, but also I think there is no way to prove it. Another speculation, now, so I put it under the label of speculation.
You are using a particular neutron star to speculate, it's 1913 or like system, which will take a long time to coalesce, but you really don't know whether there exists a population of neutron stars.
Yes. Yes.
Much shorter.
Yes, of course, of
and
course.
There's a huge reason we won't know that for a long time.
Because it's difficult to catch them.
Right.
Of course, of course. Still, we have, I think we should realize that all of that is just speculation. Because we don't have direct empirical evidence in favor or really strong evidence against. The same goes for young massive stars, which recently became quite popular. The end product is basically the same. You end up with a black hole and a torus, or perhaps a neutron star and a torus, as Usov suggested. In this case, in order to have rapid spin, we need a progenitor to be a member of a close binary system. But that's all right. We have many binary stars, and the statistics is pretty poorly known. And a simple-minded prediction here is that this should be near star-forming region. But as Sri pointed out, once we have evidence from observations that, in fact, gamma ray bursts are in galaxies, in some cases, in some of the dusty or gaseous regions, people started to think a bit harder, and they find all kinds of ways to make the first scenario not in conflict with that location. I think there is... They move far away.
There are pairs of neutron stars which are born very close.
No, in that paper what I remember is that they found a very broad distribution of a distance they can travel. Which means that of course you would have some which merge quickly, but you would have some which merge far away. And in terms of nature of those mergers, there was nothing strikingly different. So, for any binary which merges nearby the place of origin, there should be another one which merges far away. So, that was all along from the very beginning, from that paper you referred to. So, it's not that this predicts none of them should be near star-forming regions, but there should be some distribution. And so far, we are, I mean, there is one case where there is no host galaxy detectable to 27th magnitude, but then of course in some cases we do know there should be some galaxies fainter than 27th magnitude. To have 10 other cases where there is a clear host galaxy suggests that in the small number of statistics we have some indication that gamma ray bursts are not forming very far away from star-forming regions. Sorry? No, I'm talking only about old long gamma ray bursts, as I mentioned before, because that's the only category about which we know anything. About others, we don't. Now, there's another difference which I have not noticed here. I noticed that only during this conference. A very natural prediction of the second scenario is that any violent event is preceded by a dense stellar wind, whereas you do not expect much of a wind precursor in emerging compact star scenario. At the moment, the observational evidence is sort of mixed. For some, it is claimed that there is a clean interstellar medium around, no evidence for the wind, actually evidence against the wind. For some others, there seems to be a need for a wind. So I think we should not be too desperate. Things are just beginning to happen. And I think, again, one can twist things in theoretical models after the fact, but I think it is fair to say that before the fact, a fair expectation in this case is, well, if there is any wind, it will be marginal and just preceding the merger, whereas in this case there should be a strong wind for a long time preceding the merger. So in principle, afterglow behavior should allow us to differentiate between one and another, irrespective of our ability or lack of that to explain how do you get a gamma ray burst from any of these. Yes? I have no idea how to get high Lorentz factor under any circumstances. So I think this is completely different. Yes, that's I think originally suggested by Usov, and maybe that works. Also, please note, because there is some misconception, this scenario requires high rotation speed. That implies there is no extended stellar envelope. And supernova 1998 BW is a nice example. There, in that case, there was not only no hydrogen envelope, but there was even no helium envelope. And the reason why you don't have an envelope is that the only way we know of how to maintain rapid rotation is to have a binary which is very compact. There is no room for the envelope. So it is true that the outer parts of the star do not know the inner parts have collapsed, but we are talking about outer core and the inner core. No envelope there. Still, it's absolutely obvious that we have no idea how to make the cleanup probably easier than anything else. However, there may be a hint. This is pure speculation. Somebody brought up here yesterday or 2 days ago the issue that there are supposedly X-ray precursors seen in some cases. Ginga, I think, is the primary source of the concept of X-ray precursors. I think that is, in a way, perhaps a hint of what is happening in this speculative scenario. You have a supernova explosion which blows off everything, but even more violently than 1998 BW, and that produces basically a supernova plus X-ray bursts or X-ray transient, because you are talking about here the bulk of mass which is going sub-relativistically, as it was the case with the observed case of the supernova 1998 BW. It was happening, never mind whether it was or was not associated with the gamma ray burst. We have clear observational evidence for sub-relativistic, perhaps even relativistic expansion in that explosion, never mind gamma ray burst. And then only when you have exploded most of the gas and the density is reasonably low, the central engine may penetrate with the jet, whatever lower density ejecta there are. And that's why gamma ray bursts comes with some delay compared to the X-ray precursor. That's sheer speculation. But I think in that respect, the supernova 1998 BW is very important. It shows there are very powerful explosions on a scale significantly higher than typical type 1 or type 2. And therefore, we should allow for the possibility that something more powerful than an ordinary supernova is possible. Now, here is a diagram where a term hypernova is present. I have not invented it. The term hypernova is scattered over literature for at least a decade, maybe 2 decades. So this is a simple diagram which shows basically light curves of different events with names which were attached to them. So we have novae, which are clearly explosive events. We have so-called dwarf novae. They have light curves somewhat similar to novae, but on a much reduced intensity scale. But they are not explosive. Then we have supernovae, again, vastly more powerful than novae, hence the name supernova. I believe the name supernova was invented to ridicule the concept, and then it stayed. That was claimed that if M31 was not in our galaxy, then that nova from the end of last century would have to be a supernova. And, well, it turned out to be a supernova. Then when you look at the first light curve for which we had data, the first gamma ray burst with the redshift, that's the optical afterglow. It's several hundred times brighter than the brightest supernova. So basically it seems quite appropriate to use another term. You can say super-supernova, super-dupernova. Well, why not hypernova? Because that term has already been used in literature in the context of something very powerful, more powerful than supernova. Now, then you can ask yourself the question, what is a hypernova? Well, there are three levels to that. Mm-hmm. One is just a name. It's just a matter of linguistics. If you have something which is more powerful than a supernova, I call it hypernova. I think it's just as good justification as any. This is, can be debated in terms of language, but not science. Then you have a second issue which is testable. Just, you may say, well, if it is really not just a name, but something related to supernovae, this should be a violent death of a massive star, just like supernovae, except more powerful. This is testable, and that's what I was trying to bring up with the previous view graph. We would expect a violent death of a massive star to be near star-forming regions. There should be lots of debris. We should think in terms of testable, purely astronomical consequences of an explosion of a massive star with lots of matter around it versus an explosive event from a compact object. So I think this is reasonably testable, and my guess is that in a few years we shall know is the answer yes, no, or both. And then we have sheer speculation that this powerful explosion has something to do, say, with a magnetically driven jet. I am somewhat attached to this idea for the following reason. Spherical models of collapsing massive stars seem to be totally unable to release much more than 10 to 51 Earths per object. And I think Stan may tell us something about it in a few minutes. People studied massive stars, supermassive stars. Somehow it was not possible to get more energy than that. Whereas if you have a rotation, it was pointed out long, long time ago. For me, the first time I noticed that from the old paper by Gunn and Ostreicher, but probably many other people noticed that as well, if you have rotation, you have a reservoir of energy which can be comparable to the gravitational binding energy, and therefore a fair fraction of the rest mass energy, which is not readily disposed of. So you have this battery, and the question is, can you tap that battery? Can you transfer energy from rotation to explosion? And whether this can be done this particular way, I don't know. That's sheer speculation, but I think it's very tempting for me to speculate along these lines. And I think many of us are tempted to speculate along these lines. There is no shortage of possible progenitors. Wolf Rayet type stars, Centaurus X3, are likely short period binaries. Centaurus X3 has a period, Cygnus X3, of course. Cygnus X3 has a period of 4 hours. There are several other Wolf Rayet binaries which have periods of only a few hours. So these are prime candidates for core collapses accompanied with a lot of rotation. I think I'm running out of time in spite of what I thought. It turns out I can talk more than I thought I could. This is a picture which has nothing to do with gamma ray bursts. That's a Subaru picture of a star-forming region in Orion. It doesn't show up that well on the screen. If you look at the original image, especially on the computer screen, the impression of explosion is very strong. And this is a picture which looks like a cartoon of explosion. Look at these things here. What I think when I see that, look at that, is imagine a gamma ray burst is like this. And then we have our spherical cow models of something which may be as complicated as this thing is. And that is pretty depressing. I think as I'm running out of time, I probably will just leave this here and stop. Thank you.
Historically, back in the 50s, Suki stem also been some type 3 system where here it says very energetic.
Mm-hmm. He had even 8 types, I suppose.
Why? The question back to the whether you expect that in these scenarios that you always
So basically, if I understand you correctly, in the language which I would use, after the afterglow, there should be a remnant phase, just as we have supernova remnants. And you and others suggested that perhaps some very energetic supernova-like remnants, which typically people suggested come because of 100 or maybe 1,000 supernova explosions, maybe due to just single gamma ray burst explosion. I would like to make, I think I'm all for it, and I think studies of such things will likely help us. It would certainly help to have a gamma ray burst nearby. And if you note...
Not too nearby.
The trouble is that so far all the six are very far away. And if hypothesis that the burst rate is proportional to star formation rate, which holds for both scenarios I've talked about, either old or relatively old or relatively young massive stars, then there should be very few gamma ray bursts nearby, which means we probably need at least 100 redshifts before we get one, which would be, say, something like 0.2. Basically, there's not only very little volume near us, the star formation rate is perhaps factor of 10 lower near us than it is at the redshift 1, where we see gamma ray bursts. So this is one case where we really desperately need a large number of redshift measurements. Once we see a thing really relatively nearby, I mean at a safe distance, we can hope to resolve it in radio, perhaps in optical, look at the early phases of the X-ray remnant when it becomes, I mean, this non-relativistic ejecta catch up. There is one cautionary remark here. I think there is no question, doubt on my mind that neutron star mergers happen. I mean, people calculated it from all kinds of different ends. Hypernova explosions certainly happen. 1998 BW was one of them. The question is, do they produce gamma ray bursts? It's up in the air. Which basically means that there will be vastly more of those events than there are gamma ray bursts. And they may produce hypernova remnants, which will be totally unrelated to gamma ray bursts. Certainly, afterglows are easier to produce than gamma ray bursts. Gamma ray bursts, we know, require Lorentz factors of several hundred. You can get an afterglow with a Lorentz factor of 10. So for every afterglow associated with the gamma ray burst, there may be many more afterglows which are not related to gamma ray bursts. I think the only way to sort it out is to have vastly better understanding of what flashes up, what explodes out there in the universe. If we have 10,000 supernovae, if we have more rossi-type flashes, yes, then we shall possibly be able to sort things out. But there's a tremendous amount of homework to be done. Yes?
The magnetic gaps, I agree with you, are a very reasonable place to look. The problem is in getting the magnetic energy, we classically might think it's produced at some kind of chapter in the biggest quasar ATM. How do you get it to come out explosively? Unfortunately, the physics of this is tied up in this problem that some $10 billion spent on and more, namely understanding the interruptions and focus. You know that's what really stopped Iger. And it's a chunk of physics, plasma physics, that is still missing. But my guess is, if I really have to swallow this cosmological thing, the logical place is in the magnetic jets of quasars and understand how they can behave a brief moment, like we see endlessly in photons.
Well, that's getting too technical for anybody but two of you to understand it. Ralph, sorry.
Yes, I have a question about the issue of rapid rotation and closed binaries. And one is, I guess, a comment, and that is that we seem to see some magnetic white dwarfs that rotate much more rapidly than they ought to if they come from singular giants, and still they seem to come from singular giants. So maybe we should be sure that rapid rotation of stellar core can only occur in a closed binary star.
There is this beautiful series of papers by Socker about the rapid rotation of horizontal branch stars, blue horizontal branch stars, that's because they swallow planets. And that explains both rapid rotation and randomness of the mass loss required to populate broad range of colors for horizontal branch stars. And I think that is all you need to get really slow white dwarf rotation. You swallow a planet, you do it.
I guess the other comment is if you have close binaries, that we may somewhat muddy the waters in respect of the separation of the progenitor from the star forming region, because many close binaries at some point or other in their lives become runaway binaries, possibly so.
Agreed? Yes. So things get messy.
Yeah.
Agreed?
They don't run away if they merge.
Well, if they first run away after the first explosion and they merge prior to the second explosion, I think it, with enough. Well, I think it would take no more than a few minutes for a bunch of binary types to figure out a scenario. The problem would be how plausible it is, what fraction of the events would be, but there is a danger. I mean, I think this is a nice example of a twist on massive death concept, massive star death concept, where you can get some far away from star forming regions if you are desperate. Just as with merging compact objects, if you are desperate, you can twist your statistics so that they will, most of them will not run away too far. It's just messy astronomy, unfortunately. Yes.
My question, or maybe comments, is about the light curve of this classical gamma ray.
Mm-hmm.
It looks like during this 10, 30, 100 seconds, a lot of things happens when the explosion takes place. And I wonder why the first peak which you will see at the light curve is so much similar to the latest peaks which we see through many, many different processes, when there are already early afterglow, this reverse shock, some.
I don't know, I don't speak here about theory. I don't know if I believe in forward reverse shocks. I mean, these are nice concepts, spherical cow type models. Which peak do you have in mind? The optical flash by Rotzi?
No, I'm speaking about time profile of bursts.
Gamma ray bursts.
Gamma ray
bursts. Oh, now we are talking about what makes gamma ray bursts function.
And the question is, why I do not see very evident evolution?
That's a very good question. That is, I mean, the thing is really puzzling for me. I talked quite a lot with Ed Fenimore when he was still here. There is clear evolution in spectra. Spectra get softer with time, and that's a steady trend. There is also intensity evolution. Bursts are time asymmetric. On typical rise time is shorter than typical decline time. However, there is this truly mysterious thing which Fenimore put on the AstroPH recently. You align the first, the middle, and the last peak in a burst. And the time profiles, they are normalized in the peak. So the peak itself is normalized to unity for all of them. But look at the sharpness. There is no evolution, from just as what you meant in mind. For whatever reason, whereas spectrum evolves, overall time profile evolves, profiles of individual components of the burst don't seem to evolve. What to make of it? I have no idea. The chemistry.
That may be a little less mysterious. So imagine, why would you think that heat is the heat source of the substructure or internal central engines, but it can very well be independent random events that don't know and don't care whether it's the beginning of a burst or the end of a burst. On the other hand, the time asymmetry of bursts overall, the corresponding spectral softening that we've been looking at for decades, if you attribute that overall envelope for burst to an external shock, in other words, the beginning of the afterglow, then you expect both the softening, the lengthening of the time profile to go down in energy.
No, but that softening of the spectrum and the overall asymmetry is within this
so
domain of this three.
In a burst with multiple subspeaks.
Yes.
You treat that internal shock produced by a central engine that doesn't know anything about a medium. It's a stationary, statistically stationary process, except at some level it has to run out of energy. So but the gradual softening of time asymmetries is attributable to the interaction with the surrounding media, which is a process of
I don't understand what you are saying, because that overall spectrum is made of this component, not something else.
No, it's also made up of a broad smooth part. It's quite possible that the softening spectrum is a smooth part, not the
thank you. Okay. This sounds like a good topic for one of the late afternoon discussions.